Don't need to see it again. He heard the planes again, the roar growing closer, and he saw them coming up the draw straight overhead. He had a burst of panic, thought, No! Oh, Christ, not now! He slid quickly down through the snow, kicked through brush, running now, closer to the others. The rest of the squad had stopped, squatted low, watching the planes, and Riley glanced back, the planes gone now, the far side of the ridge. He was breathing in hard gasps, and Welch said, Easy, Pete. The son of a bitch waved at me. They know we're here. They're keeping the chinks off our tails, God bless 'em. The planes returned, the roar of the engines and the hard rattle of their machine guns. One plane peeled off, rolled out to one side, swung around, and Riley watched the nose of the plane pointing straight toward them. He called out, pointed, the others watching the plane, all of them dropping flat. The Corsair was barely 20 feet above the rocky hill, the machine guns opening now, the flickers of fire along the wings. Riley felt frozen, terror enveloping him, but the plane dipped lower still, firing down into the draw beneath them. The plane roared straight over them now, close enough to touch, and Riley felt a hard impact on his head. More falling around him. The men yelling in panic, and Welch shouted, Shells! Empties, you idiots! Riley saw now pockets of steam in the snow, the spent shells from the Corsair's guns splattering the hillside around them. His legs gave out, and he sat in the snow, reached down, retrieved an empty 50-caliber shell. It was still warm to the touch, and he cupped it in his hands, then slipped it into his pocket. Welch was still standing, said in a low voice, You got your damn souvenir? Let's get back up the ridge before it's too dark for those numbskulls up there to see who we are. And keep an eye on this draw. That flyboy saw something worth shooting at.
Goolsby was up beside Welch, said, Let's go. Head back. We'll try again tomorrow.
Riley saw something fragile in the man's face, his voice a weak quiver. He looked at Welch, who returned the glance, said nothing. There was a pop from the draw down below. A single shot, and Goolsby sat suddenly, looked at his hands, one reaching for his shoulder.
Oh, I got stung.
Welch was down beside him, said,
You hit? Where?
Goolsby looked at him, then at the others, seemed confused. Riley moved closer, saw Welch push the lieutenant's hands aside, staring into his chest, pulling the coat back off his shoulder. And now a sharp whistle, the dull smack. Goolsby knocked flat on his back. Riley saw the hole, blood in a light stream from Goolsby's forehead, and Welch shouted, Down! They flattened out in the snow and brush, more firing from down below, cutting the snow around them. Welch crawled up through the brush, said,
Give 'em hell, then get your asses up that way. Get to the cover in those rocks.
Welch rose to one knee, emptied the Thompson into the brush below, Kane firing the BAR, the others joining in. Riley stared, searching for any kind of targets, and he fired the Thompson, aiming low, shredding the brush. Welch said to Kane,
Give it to him again, then haul your ass up this hill.
Kane reloaded the BAR, fired again, and the others moved quickly up through the snow and brush, slipping into the rocks. Riley watched Welch, who emptied the Thompson one more time, and Riley looked again at Goolsby. He slid down toward the man, one hand on Goolsby's coat, tugged, and Welch was now beside him.
We can't leave him, Sarge. Didn't intend to. Grab his hand.
The fire from below had stopped, Kane above them firing the BAR one more time. Riley worked with Welch, pulling Goolsby's body up toward the others, toward the safety of the rocks. Two more men now took the job, Kane and Norman grabbing Goolsby's hands, Riley struggling to breathe. Welch had one hand on his shoulder, said between breaths,
Let's go. We chased that bunch off, I think, but they'll be back. Let's get the hell out of here. You okay?
Riley watched the men dragging Goolsby, making their way up past the rocks, the heavier snow, moving past the frozen bodies of the enemy. Riley saw others up on the ridge, Marines watching the scene, rifles ready, offering help if the enemy was following. Riley stopped at a fat rock, sat, and Welch looked back at him.
What's up?
Just a minute, Hamp. Gotta get my breath.
It'll be dark in 5 minutes. Let's get back home.
Welch was catching his own breath, said in a low voice.
He never should have been out here. Too green. Irish called it. Said he'd never make it.
Riley looked at Welch, said,
We were all green.
The lieutenant was no worse than you.
Welch looked at him, said,
He's dead. That makes him worse. Let's go.
Riley looked again at the ridgeline. Two more men coming downhill, taking their turn with the lieutenant, the others staring down the hill, searching for any sign of the enemy. Riley struggled to get to his feet, the Thompson heavier still, aching weakness in his knees, his shoulders, his back. He tasted the cold again, the temperature dropping with the setting of the sun, the icy sting returning to his face, the miserable wetness in his shoe packs. He looked up at Welch, who held out a hand, helping Riley up past the rocks. Riley took a long, icy breath, said,
Damn, I'm hungry.
Chapter 32 Riley. The breakout from Udom Knee had begun just after dawn on December 1st, Litzenberg and Murray uniting their efforts in a well-organized push that drove them straight into the Chinese troops who had cut off the road to the south. Murray's 5th led the way, while several units of the 7th held their position in Udom Knee, keeping the Chinese troops behind them at bay. The 8,000 Marines moved slowly, methodically, accompanied by a single tank, the only armor they had. To each side of the road, the tall hills hid more of the enemy, and Murray sent his lead troops forward in three prongs, two of them high up, pushing the Chinese back along both sides of the road. The 3rd kept to the road itself, marching with the long train of vehicles that carried the hundreds of wounded. Several miles to their front, both commanders knew they could not just march to Hagaru Re without passing first through the narrow defiles of Tok Tong Pass, the most vulnerable part of the march. Some 4 miles south of Udom Knee, short of the pass, one battalion of the 7th, roughly 400 men, branched off, leaving the main convoy behind. They were commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Ray Davis, a rugged 35-year-old, a veteran of some of the worst fights the Marines had endured during World War II. With darkness falling late on December 1st, Davis led his men up the tall hills to the east of the main road, knowing they would confront heavy concentrations of Chinese, with their only advantage coming from the darkness and all the stealth the Marines could muster. Their mission was not to engage the enemy, but, if possible, to slip past him, avoiding a major confrontation that might halt Davis's men altogether. Through the frozen darkness, they were to cross the rugged hills, trudge through the deep passes, and, following maps that were obsolete at best, attempt to locate and rescue the men of Fox Company. Whether there was anyone left to rescue, or whether the Chinese had completely obliterated Barber's command, was a question no one could answer. Throughout the night, Davis's men made their way over some of the roughest ground they had experienced. The Chinese they confronted were mostly caught off guard, but there were fights, clumsy and chaotic, the battalion taking casualties Davis had hoped to avoid. Wounded men only added to the challenge, the blinding darkness obliterating any kind of landmark, the men guided by compasses that now failed to work. frozen. The men struggled to keep to any kind of direction, the hillsides swallowing their bearings, no guidance coming from anyone behind them, no artillery, no aircraft. For a while, Davis attempted to guide his men by the stars, but the weariness of the exhausted men made mental exercises required for navigation all but impossible. Trudging onward, stumbling into a surprised, often sleeping enemy, Davis discovered pockets of Chinese soldiers who had frozen to death, unable to protect themselves from the 30-below-zero temperatures. As the night wore on, Davis recognized that his men were barely functioning, and he ordered a halt, allowing most to rest in the relative comfort of their sleeping bags. But with so many pockets of the enemy around them, sleep was out of the question, and so Davis and his officers moved along the ragged line of march, prodding the men into as much alertness as they could muster. With dawn approaching, the firefights seemed to grow more numerous and more intense, the confrontations alerting more of the Chinese that their enemy was surprisingly close. Studying his map by flashlight, the bleary-eyed and foggy-brained Davis continued to guide the men toward what he had to believe was his intended goal. Close to dawn, his radio man was suddenly wide awake, offering Davis exactly what Davis was hoping to hear. Fox Hill, December 2, 1950, 7 a.m. Welch had met with the remaining sergeants who still manned 3rd Platoon's position. The consensus that at least one of them should check in on the battered 2nd Platoon, Lieutenant Peterson's command, which had continued to receive the same pressure from the Chinese assaults. As the casualty count mounted, the gaps in the line were increasing. Some of the positions occupied by wounded men brought back up the hill from the aid stations, anyone who could still squeeze a trigger. But across from them, on the rocky hill, and the wider hill beyond the road to the west, it was clear that the Chinese had continued to regroup, still pushing forward more troops, preparing, yet again, for their next assault. Fox Hill was defended now by half the force that had first established the line, men whose rations had run dry, whose lack of sleep had dulled the minds, the relentless assaults draining away any strength at all. But still, they held to their foxholes, shifting positions, hanging on to the hilltop that Captain Barber had insisted was their only remaining mission. There was no alternative. Riley had insisted Welch not make the short journey down towards 2nd Platoon by himself, and surprisingly, Welch did not object. It was one more sign that even the strongest men were losing command of themselves, that the fight they made now was as much by instinct as by following orders. Even if there was no real purpose to the journey, Riley accepted that a walk, even a frozen one, might help wake them both up from the sluggishness of their hunger, might loosen up the stiffness in every limb from the relentless cold. They stumbled over the snow-covered rocks, and Riley tried to watch the saddle, a useless exercise. The snipers were still active, Riley's brain teasing him into believing he might see them before they took their shot, before the worst could happen. The worst, so far, had come the day before. The image of Goolsbee's death ground into his brain. He had mourned the man's death with paralyzing grief, some of that the product of sleeplessness and hunger. He tried to think of the man's first name, couldn't recall it. Felt foolish asking anyone else. He wanted to offer the lieutenant an apology, did so in his thoughts throughout the long night, wondering if Goolsbee had known of the rude comments, Killian and the others, the 90-day wonder, shave tail, all those monikers the veterans gave fresh-faced officers. He scolded himself even now, stumbling behind the cover of taller rocks, halting with Welch for a gasp of frozen air. "Stop this. He's dead, and you might be too if you don't get a handle on this." Welch moved again, the Thompson dangling from his shoulder and Riley followed. Another glance toward the rocky hill. There had been casualties all throughout the night, some of those from carelessness or simply bad luck, sprays of machine gun fire that blew into men who might have been away from their foxholes, if only for a moment, trying to stretch, to bring life to dead limbs. He felt guilty for not visiting Killian, but for now there wasn't much point. The wounded were still down there in the tents, more vulnerable now than any day so far, the men on the hill who protected them weakening by the hour. He hadn't even asked Welch about going down, knew instinctively that the energy required for the climb might be too costly, that if the enemy came again that night, he would need everything left inside him to stand tall, to make another tough fight. Killian would understand, he thought. He'd kick me in the ass if I wasn't up here doing the job just so I could hold his hand. They moved past scrambling supply men, a pair of stretcher bearers, and Riley saw the lines of foxholes facing west. The men barely visible, protected by the mounds of Chinese corpses. He couldn't avoid shivering, his breathing punching his lungs with frigid air. The hood of his parka was clamped tight around his head, the three pairs of socks on his feet less effective with each new gust of brutal wind. He saw a light wisp of smoke rising from below ground, and Welch halted, searched, a low voice to one side from one of the holes.
"What's up?"
Welch moved that way, Riley following. The familiar face of Lieutenant Peterson, sitting low in a hole. Welch crawled low, Riley doing the same, both men down in the snow. Welch said,
"Thought I should report to you, sir. No officers on our side of the hill. Not sure if anything's going on we ought to know about."
There was firing out past the rocky hill, distant sounds that echoed faintly. Riley turned that way, and Peterson shifted in the hole, said,
"Heard that for a while now. It's not aimed this way, so I'm not sure what to do about it. I'm not too mobile right now."
Riley peered down over the edge of the foxhole, the repairs to Peterson's wounds hidden by the heavy coat, the sleeping bag over his legs. Welch said,
"You okay, sir? We can still get a corpsman up here if we need one." "Leave them be for now. I got half a dozen holes in me, but I'm still here. Unless they blow my hands off, I can fire a rifle. The only officer on the hill not wounded yet is Lieutenant Dunn. First platoon has had it easy so far. The enemy keeps pushing us from this direction, like he knows we're shot full of holes. If Dunn tries to help us out, shifting any of his people around to this side, the Chinese will see that, and sure as hell they'll bust up the hill in his sector. They're out there in every direction." He paused, seemed to gather strength. "I heard about Lieutenant Goolsby." "Tough."
Welch said,
"Yeah, we were there."
"I'll put him in for a citation if you want to. That's the way it works sometimes. Dead men aren't too humble to accept medals. Last I heard, Lieutenant McCarthy's doing okay. Nasty wound, but in the right place. Not sure how much longer we're going to be up here, but at least nobody's bleeding to death. Too damn cold." Riley said, "How's the captain?" Welch looked at him, too tired to scold him. Peterson didn't seem to mind the question, said, "His wound's gotten bad. The doc says it's infected and getting worse. I told him to keep down near his CP. No need for him to risk his stretcher bearers just so he can make an inspection. He's already lost two of his runners." Welch looked out past the distant rocks.
"It's gotten heavier." "Who's doing all that shooting? We heard the artillery at Udomni a couple days ago. But that's not artillery. Too light.
And too close. No idea, Sergeant. Maybe it's John Wayne and the South Korean cavalry coming to our rescue. Hagaru Ri's the other way, so it ain't help from down there. Right now, it's somebody else's problem. We got our hands full holding the enemy off this hill. Get back to your men. Tell them to keep doing what they've been doing. Air cover will be here soon, I hope. The captain's radio's maybe got enough juice to last an hour. and he's hoping to hear something from those boys before it conks out again. Riley heard the sharp zip, the ping of lead off a rock to one side. He put his head down flat in the snow, pressed up closer to one of the corpses, and Peterson said, "Careful. That son of a bitch out there knows I'm here, and he must have some idea I'm in charge. He keeps me honest about every 20 minutes. Keep back to those rocks over that way. That seems to be safe."
"Sir?" Peterson responded. "Who the hell is calling me, sir?"
The man fell flat, close to Riley, crawled forward, out of breath.
"Sorry. Captain wanted me to get up here, tell you what's up."
The man ran out of words, gasping for air, and Peterson said, "So? What's up? MacArthur still saying we'll be home for Christmas?"
"Sir, the radio. We got a call. There's Marines coming this way. You're to order your men to hold their fire if they see personnel out toward the Rocky Hill."
Peterson didn't respond. A long silence, and Riley could hear the sounds from the distant fight, sporadic now, small pops. Welch said, "I guess that would be them." Peterson struggled to stand. Another man close by.
"Sir, the sniper!"
Peterson stared out that way, propped against the corpses in front of him. "I have a feeling that guy has his hands full. He can hear what we're hearing." Peterson looked at Barbara's man, said, "Whose Marines? Did they say?"
"First Battalion, 7th, sir."
"Davis. Figures. He's buddies with Chesty Puller. They're always trying to outdo each other for balls."
He paused, stared toward the sounds of the fight. Almost nothing now.
"He brought a whole damn battalion over that miserable ground just to help us get off this damn hill? I think Chesty will like that."
Fox Hill, December 2nd, 11 a.m. The Corsairs came again, the saddle and much of the rocky knoll bathed in a bright shower of napalm. The men along the ridgeline watched as they had before, grateful for the attention from the air wing. Riley, as curious as any of them, just what it was like to fly the big blue birds. With the raid passed, the enemy's guns had fallen silent, the last firefight erupting close to the rocky knoll on the big hill. The men on Fox Hill, surprised to see an eruption of Chinese soldiers boiling up from hidden places, most of them scattering off into the deep draws. Soon after, the men with binoculars passed the word there were troops moving out along the distant ridges, and they were not Chinese. Within minutes, Marines were advancing across the saddle toward them, more men coming up from the low places alongside. Riley stood in the foxhole, laid the Thompson down, stared with Welch, neither man speaking. All along the line, cheers began to flow out, shouts and greetings, the Marines moving up toward them, responding with calls of their own. Welch climbed up without speaking, moved out past the muzzle of the machine gun, Riley struggling to follow. He stepped once more past the walls of bodies, stood alongside Welch, watched the Marines as they made contact with the others along the ridge. Hands went out, more loud talk, and Riley felt a shiver, raw emotion, tried to blink through the frosty tears in his eyes. Two men made their way up the hill straight below them, filthy, bearded faces, ragged coats over dirty pants, one man calling out, pulling a can from his pocket.
"Howdy, Marine. They told us you might be hungry. Got some beef stew here, if you want it."
Welch took the can, mumbled something, his voice low, his head down. The man pulled out another can, offered it to Riley, who stared at the man's outstretched hand, the dull green tin. Riley felt the strength go out of his legs, and he dropped down to his knees, sat back on his heels, too weak to raise his arm. The man stepped closer, stuffed the can into Riley's coat pocket. "Maybe later, then." The other Marine pulled more rations from his coat, tossed them into the foxhole behind Riley, and after a quiet moment, Welch offered the man his hand, said,
"What took you so damn long?"
The first man smiled, said, "It's kind of a hike, and there's about 5 million Chinese tried to stop us. The colonel wasn't sure just what we'd find. It's good to see you boys are still up here. But I gotta say, you look like hell." Throughout the day, on December 2nd, Captain Barber ordered the preparation for his men to evacuate their position on Fox Hill. The wounded were, of course, the first priority, their number increasing by 24 more, the casualties Davis's battalion had taken on their extraordinary journey. While Fox Company gathered up their own gear, anything worth retrieving, Davis's men continued their mission. The hills around Tok Tong Pass were still infested with Chinese, men who had kept their distance as they observed this fresh influx of strength. Davis's men were now the aggressors, driving the Chinese away from any place around Tok Tong Pass where they might still pose a threat. Aided by raids from the corsairs and blistering fire from the artillery at Hagaru Ri, by nightfall most of the enemy concentrations had been either driven away or destroyed. With darkness settling over them one more time, the men of Barber's command were poised for the march down off Fox Hill. Of the 240 men who had begun the fight, barely 80 had survived without wounds. As Davis's men continued to sweep the surrounding heights, Barber's Marines kept watch on what had been the enemy positions, the rocky knolls and deep draws where so many assaults had come before. Instead of the bugles and whistles that had become a terrifying part of their nightly routine, the Marines were startled by an entirely new sound, the familiar clanking grind of a lone tank as it wound through the narrow pass below them. With the tank came the vanguard of Murray's 5th, followed by Litzenberg's 7th, and back behind them, scattered formations of the Chinese still willing to pursue them. But Barber's men understood that the men coming down the main road were more than just their own salvation. Word passed quickly that the evacuation from Udomni was complete. The Marines pushing their convoy of heavy equipment and wounded men southward, with only a few miles to go before they reached Hagaru Ri. Chapter 33. Smith. Hagaru Ri, December 3, 1950, 10 a.m. The survivors of Task Force Faith had continued to straggle into Hagaru Ri, men alone, others in groups of a dozen or more. The greatest surprise had come out on the ice of the frozen reservoir. Hundreds of soldiers fleeing the Chinese by drifting out onto the wide open, coverless terrain, shuffling through several inches of fresh snow, some carrying the men who could not walk by themselves. As they came into view of the forward observation posts, one Marine officer had reacted by commandeering one of his jeeps, and accompanied by a convoy of vehicles and a team of his own subordinates, he had driven onto the ice, pushing out as far as he dared. Unsure of the thickness of the ice beneath him and coming under fire from Chinese troops along the shoreline, the Marines had moved in closer on foot, corralling as many of the soldiers as they could, leading them, or in some cases carrying them, back to the safety of the lines at Hagaru Ri. Smith had heard about the rescue, was as curious about this new hero as he was the condition of the soldiers who had made it back. The jeep rolled slowly, the driver with a keen eye on the limits of the land, the snow disguising the water's edge. As they passed the last of the low huts, Smith saw smoke, a fat fire roaring near the edge of the ice, men standing close, hands out, bearded faces fixed on the flames that warmed them. Beside Smith, the driver sat hunched over in the jeep, his face wrapped, as usual, a swath of green fabric engulfing most of the man's face. Smith glanced behind him, saw the red-faced Captain Sexton, who said, "That's him in the jeep, sir. Colonel Beale."
"I know who it is."
Beside Smith, his driver said, "I heard all kinds of stories, sir. Hard to believe it." It was an odd comment to hear from the young man, who rarely offered any kind of sound but the occasional groan from the blustery winds that ripped through the jeep. Smith was curious, looked again toward the fire, the officer paying no attention to his visitors.
"Why do you say that, Corporal?"
"Well, begging your pardon, sir, but Colonel Beale is not a man prone to good deeds. I mean, he's rather a tough nut. Every time I have your vehicles serviced or even cleaned up, I catch all kinds of grief for it. The colonel seems to be unhappy most all the time." The young man paused. "Oh, gee, sir, I didn't mean nothing. Shouldn't have spoke up." Smith glanced back at Sexton, saw a smile through cracked lips. He was still curious. Said to the driver,
"I know Colonel Beale, son. Heads up the 1st Motor Battalion, and there's nobody better for the job. Most of those motor pool fellows aren't happy unless they've got a wrench in their hands and grease on their uniforms."
Sexton said, "I think the corporal here has learned that those motor boys love their steel hardware as much as the artillery or the tank drivers do. I dented up a jeep once, and Beale, Colonel Beale, threw enough cussing at me to start a forest fire." Smith heard the humor in Sexton's voice, ignored it.
"Both of you need to pay a little more attention to a man's deeds instead of his mouth. Colonel Ridge has made it pretty clear to me that Colonel Beale has saved some lives, and maybe a whole lot of them. I want to hear more about it from him."
Beside him, the driver kept his head down, said, "Well, yes, sir, that's what I'll say from now on, I promise, sir." Smith looked again at the young man, thought, "Not everybody here has to be buddies, and not every officer is a nice guy. I'm not sure what this particular bug is about. Maybe I should keep it that way."
"Stay here, son. Keep the jeep running. Captain, follow me."
Smith stepped out of the jeep, eyed the gathering of men around the fire. There were 24 or more, ragged and filthy, no weapons. Beale now speaking to the men as though they were there for inspection.
"Pay attention. Warming tents are over that way, and there's rations just passed in the mess tents. Lieutenant Hunt here will show you the way. I'm heading back out, seeing if I can round up any more of you characters."
Smith saw Hunt now, the young officer buried in his coat, responding to Beale's command, herding the troops into a makeshift parade, leading them to a waiting truck. Smith focused more on the soldiers now, some men barely able to walk, assisted by others in no better condition. He let them pass, the lieutenant eyeing him, a sudden salute.
"Sir!"
Smith returned it with a gloved hand, said nothing. The soldiers moving past him at a shuffle, most ignoring him. There was no talk, no smiles, and Smith had a sudden thought, the image of prisoners of war marching off to their camps. Sexton was beside him now, cold legs marching in place, the futile routine of every one of his staff when he brought them out into the chill. He felt it himself, the usual tremors in his hands, clamped them under his arms, moved closer to the fire and Beale's jeep. Beale jumped down, seemed to notice the two officers for the first time, and Smith saw annoyance on the man's face, a snarl of impatience.
"What can I do for you two?"
Smith said nothing, stood straight, gave Beale the time to study him. He saw it now, the burst of recognition in the colonel's eyes, but Beale was unrepentant, said,
"Didn't expect to see you, General. I've got to get back out on the ice. My boys are out there still, hauling in whatever catch we can find."
Olin Beale was nearly as old as Smith, the Hollywood image of the crusty old veteran with more than 30 years in the Corps. He was one of the very few men Smith had in his command who had actually served in World War I.
"Colonel, I've been told you're doing some fine work out here. How many men have you found?"
He knew Beale would appreciate a minimum of conversation. Beale nodding briefly, the only show of formality he offered. "Dozens? Lost count, but I'll have a report for you when we're done. They're a mess, General. No fight left in 'em at all. Found a pile of 'em hiding along the shoreline, any place they could keep away from the enemy. Some of 'em couldn't walk, frostbite, whatnot. Took some of my trucks out there the last run and hauled a bunch straight to the tents. They're mostly frozen stiff. Some bad wounds. Some of 'em are worth a salute, helping the worst of the wounded. Brave damn men. Others, well, less so. Damn Chinese tried to slow us down. We took out a pile of snipers along the shore. Sir, I need to get back out there. No idea how many more we'll find." Smith nodded, Beale responding without speaking, jumping into the jeep, driving it himself, spinning around in the snow, a quick surge toward the edge of the reservoir. Smith watched the jeep rolling out onto the snow-covered ice, could see a small truck coming in toward him, had a sudden fear, wondered about the strength of the ice. But the two vehicles passed each other, Beale waving the truck's driver back toward the shore. Smith said to Sexton, "Only advantage to this cold. If that ice wasn't solid, there'd be an even bigger mess." Sexton shivered, said, "He's not about to lose a single jeep by drowning it. He'd rather drown you." Smith ignored the comment, said, "He deserves a medal for this." Smith blinked, the ice already crusting around his eyes. He was tempted to move closer to the fire, two of Beale's men stoking it with scrap timbers. But there was a better way to warm himself, where a coffee pot could be found. "Let's get over to the aid tent. I want a better look at some of these soldiers. If there's some officers to be found, I want to know just what happened out there." "How many more flights are we expecting today, General?" Smith removed his coat, saw the anxiety in the doctor's face. "As many as they'll send us. There's still plenty of daylight, and the enemy seems to ignore most of the planes." Herring wiped his hands on his white smock, said, "I'd like to see another couple hundred men out of here as soon as possible. I'm hoping you will allow the lot of the wounded to leave before the rest of the men. That will require a good many of those small transports." Smith tossed the coat to Sexton behind him, realized the doctor was making an assumption he had already heard from some of the other officers. "Doctor, the men who can fight are not flying out of here at all. Quite the opposite. I've ordered replacements to be flown in on the planes you're using for transport. No point in flying empty boxes up here. We've got new recruits down at the ports, plus there are a good many of the wounded who've recovered well enough to fight. I've ordered as many as possible to be transported up here." Herring seemed surprised. "Good Lord, why?" "Doctor, our next mission is to make the move southward, pulling this entire force back to the seaports. We've got far too many vehicles and far too much ordnance here just to leave it all to the enemy. If the Chinese observe us loading up plane after plane with fighting men, all hell will break out. They'll push as hard as they can, disrupt the entire operation, probably with a general assault, and I'm certain they'll do everything they can to knock those planes out of the air. We're fighting our way out of here, Doctor. There's no other way. The replacements will add considerably to our strength." Herring seemed distressed, said, "Well, in that case, I have a problem to report. I have kept a very accurate count of the wounded men whom we've prepared for evacuation, but we're shipping far more men out of here than I have on my lists. It seems, sir, that there are able-bodied men, including a good many of the newly arrived Army personnel, who are doing all they can to hitch a ride out of here, wounded or not." Now Smith was surprised, said, "That's unacceptable, Doctor. Put a stop to it." "Well, yes, sir. I'm assuming that some of the men are burying themselves under blankets and, God, I hate using the word, they're simply faking it. I came across one man, moans and groans, calling for his mama. I didn't have him on my list, so I had my aide take a look under the cover. No injury, no wound. He admitted as much, begged me to let him go. I didn't have orders not to, so we stuck him on the plane." "That was a mistake, Doctor.
How often has this happened? How many men have you let slip?
Herring folded his arms across his chest, resigned to Smith's anger. This morning I had 450 men awaiting evacuation. So far we've loaded up better than 900 men. I've no idea where they all came from. My tents couldn't hold that many if I wedged them in with a crowbar. And I still have 200 seriously wounded here waiting for a spot.
Smith felt his anger boiling, his jaw clamped tight.
How many of those men have been Marines?
You mean compared to Army troops?
I can't be sure. It seemed to us this morning that a majority of the men boarding the C-47s were Army.
Smith closed his eyes for a brief moment, thought of Almond.
He'll love it if I raise Cain about this. One more reason to slam the door on anything the Marines might need down the road. I can hear you bitching now. All we do is find reasons to fault the Army. Put a stop to this nonsense, Doctor. He turned to Sexton. Captain, have a squad of MPs sent over here on the double. I want an MP on each plane, keeping a tight watch on the boarding. Nobody leaves here who isn't worthy, who doesn't have a pass signed by Dr. Herring. You understand that?
Sexton stiffened, no sign of his usual good humor.
Completely, sir.
Sexton withdrew, and Smith glared at Herring, the doctor offering none of his usual arguments to Smith's orders. Smith said,
I want the evac area tightened up so much they won't let me on a plane. Check every man.
It will be done, sir.
Smith tried to calm down, looked across the tent, faces watching him from every cot. He suddenly recalled why he was here, lowered his voice.
Doctor, there's a Marine officer brought in this morning, Captain Stamford. I want to see him if he's able, that is, if he's still here.
The doctor seemed relieved to change the subject, said,
He's still here and he's able.
Herring checked the clipboard in his hand. I've got him scheduled to evacuate tomorrow. That last row, second cot from the end.
Smith moved that way, tried to avoid the odors, the soft sounds from those men not quite conscious. He reached Stamford's cot, saw the captain's eyes closed, had a brief argument with himself.
Don't disturb him. Well, yes, disturb him. I've got things to do. Captain, you awake?
Stamford's eyes opened, wider now, surprise on the man's face.
General Smith.
Stamford tried to raise his right arm, the instinct for saluting, thick bandages holding him back.
Leave it be, Captain. How bad are you hit?
Doc says I'll live. Guess that's the best news there is. They chewed me up pretty good. The enemy captured me twice, but they're a little sloppy. I got away from them both times. Not so some of the others. I lost two of my men, Corporal Myron Smith, Private Billy Johnson. It was pretty bad up there, sir.
I'm sorry. But I want to hear your take on what happened up there. Is it true that Colonel Faith didn't make it? Or do we list him as missing?
Stamford shook his head slowly.
He didn't make it, sir. I saw him after he was wounded. It was pretty bad. He caught a grenade. One of his people, a driver, said he died in the cab of a truck. Sorry to hear that.
More sorry than you know, sir. It's not just about being a good soldier. Colonel Faith did everything in a man's power to get his people out of that jam. Somebody let him down, sir.
It's not for me to say. Say it anyway, Captain.
Stamford seemed to study him for a long moment.
I'll not go on the record with this, sir. There's no future in it.
Smith let out a breath, sat down slowly beside the cot. A glance to the man beside Stamford, heavily bandaged around his face and head.
Captain, there's going to be hell to pay no matter what the facts are. Colonel Faith was part of my command, a choice I didn't make. But the responsibility for what happened up there is on my shoulders. Part of the job.
He paused.
And if nothing else, I would think Colonel Faith's family ought to know if he did something worth mentioning. Now, who let him down?
Stamford glanced past Smith, no other ears close enough to hear.
They left us out in the cold, sir. Whoever made the decision to pull the tanks away. We made it down to where the armor had been based. I saw a busted-up tank myself at Hudong Ni. If those boys had been there, had they come up to help us out, it might have been different.
Who gave that order, sir?
Smith shook his head.
I can't say, Captain. I won't say right now. Someone else will ask that question. Somebody with more stars on his shoulder than I have.
Sir, we were cut off completely. I did as much as I could with the air boys, and we took out a hell of a lot of Chinese. But there was no chance for us. The troops just sort of fell apart. They were green, sir, way too green to be sent out there like that. I don't fault the officers. I saw most of them go down. Good men, doing all they could to get their men to safety. There were too many Chinese. Everywhere you looked, every bend in the road, the enemy had occupied a ridge line, a hill. They poured fire on us every yard we moved.
I'll not say any more about the army, sir. I've already heard that kind of jabbering, that Marines would have walked out of there with enemy heads stuck on our bayonets. There's too much of that bull already flying around this tent.
He paused, glanced around.
There was plenty of bull up there, too.
General Almond flew up to see Colonel Faith.
I know. He flew out of here.
Well, sir, the general had a pocket full of medals with him, silver stars. He gave one to Faith. He wanted to pass them out like party favors, give one to anybody who stepped up. When he left, Colonel Faith ripped it off his coat, dropped it in the snow. General Almond acted like he was doing us a favor just by showing up.
Don Faith knew better. The general might as well have told those men they were being sacrificed, left to the four winds.
Is that what the plan was, sir?
You boys stepped in it, now figure out how to fix things yourself?
It wasn't right, sir.
He paused.
I ought not be saying this to you. When the morphine wears off, I'll wish like hell I'd have kept my mouth shut. Generals look out for each other. Isn't that how it works?
Captain, nobody's looking out for me.
I can't speak for General Almond, and I won't speak against him. But nobody's covering this up, and nobody is going to ignore what happened to Colonel Faith or his men.
Stamford turned his head, looked away.
If you say so, sir.
He could see the pain in Stamford's face, could tell the man was more angry than his wounds could tolerate. There was a pair of corpsmen watching him from across the tent, concern on their faces, and Smith stood slowly, fought the pains in his joints, knew he had taxed Stamford's energy. Stamford looked at him again, blinked wearily, unable to hide the pain, said,
"Are you a religious man, sir?"
It was an odd question, but Smith had no reason to keep anything from this man.
"I follow the Christian Scientists, Captain."
"Yes, I am."
"I just want it known, and I'll put this on the record. I swear to you, sir, Colonel Faith did all he could to save his men. They didn't have the equipment, the weaponry, and most of the soldiers didn't have the experience or the training to do the job. And worse, it was like God was looking the other way. That's what it felt like. We were marching through the worst part of hell, and no one, not even God, paid any attention."
Hagaru Ri, December 3, 1950, 2 p.m. For the better part of the day, the radios had come alive in the command tent. Word finally coming down from the main road northward, progress being made by Murray and Litzenberg. The fights were continuous, the Chinese anchored all along the route, but the reports continued to come, the latest that most of the column had pushed through Tok Tong Pass. Smith had stayed close, heard for himself the struggle of his men who pursued the enemy. By mid-afternoon, the sounds of the fighting could be heard in Hagaru Ri, occasional thunder from artillery or tank fire, the column halting long enough for the bigger guns to add their power to push away yet another Chinese roadblock. The corsairs were there as well, formations roaring past, Smith welcoming the power they added to the fight. He had gathered up most of his staff. No great challenge to that task, his headquarters still undermanned. He studied the faces, Bowser cheerful as usual, Williams, the others waiting for whatever he would tell them to do.
"Have we heard anything more from the enemy north of here?"
Bowser shook his head, said, "No more than usual. Colonel Ridge hasn't indicated any signs that the Chinese are intending to hit us here. Their focus seems to be on the men coming down the main road." Smith couldn't hide his anxiousness.
"I'm not going to sit here and jabber on the radio while those men slug it out. We're not helpless. I want a force to move out on the main road, shove up as close as possible to the lead of the column. Do what we can to eliminate the enemy who we know is standing in their way."
He was surprised to see Colonel Drysdale entering the tent, the usual spit and polish, clean-shaven, his uniform pressed.
"Oh, very sorry, sir. I did not mean to intrude. Just wanted to check on some extra rations for my wounded."
Smith didn't respond, the thought forming in his head. To one side, Colonel Williams said,
"No matter. General, if you'll allow, I can see to Colonel Drysdale's request."
Smith shook his head.
"I have a better idea. Colonel, are your men in position to embark on an assignment?"
Drysdale did not hesitate.
"By all means, sir. My men are ready for any task you wish them to undertake."
"Then undertake this. Put them to the road northward. I want them to get rid of the enemy troops who are on those closest hills. We've got a heavy column coming this way, and they've taken enough casualties."
Drysdale seemed to light up.
"If you mean, sir, that we should open the path for those boys, I'm happy to oblige. Would it be possible to add some of your tanks to our efforts? Casualties are a certainty, as you know."
"That could help."
Smith looked at Bowser.
"Colonel, order the 31st Tank Company to roll out immediately in support of the Royal Marines. Open that damn road."
Hagaru Ri, December 3rd, 7:30 p.m. With the darkness came the brutal cold, but Smith wouldn't keep to the command post. He had taken the jeep, others in line with him, moved out toward the limits of the perimeter to the north. The sounds of fighting had mostly stopped, scattered sounds coming from farther up the road, what remained of the struggle for the rear guard to hold the Chinese off the tail of the column. With the darkness, he had ordered Drysdale's men to withdraw, that if the Chinese were to make another assault, it was better if the perimeter was strong, avoiding confusion for the gunners who would target the high places along the road. He put a hand out, the silent order for the driver to halt the jeep. Smith's eyes had adjusted to the gloomy night, his ears sheltered by the hooded coat, and he slipped the coat back, strained to hear. Around him, the others were doing the same, the men along the perimeter very aware why he was out there in the cold night. Within minutes, he heard it, the rumble of trucks, the lone tank, and he stood tall in the jeep, absorbing the sounds. It was one moment of success in a campaign ripe with disasters, one mission fulfilled by men he knew he could depend on. Their mission was not yet complete, the danger far from eliminated. But now, on this one night, for a long few minutes, he allowed himself to feel their pride, their relief. They came in column, Ray Davis's men, the 1st Battalion, 7th, led by Davis himself. Behind them came the first vehicles, trucks filled with wounded men, jeeps with corpses strapped to the hoods, more bodies lashed to any piece of equipment that could hold them, including the long barrels of the artillery pieces. They approached the checkpoint, Colonel Ridge's roadblock, one foolish officer insisting that no one pass without offering up the current password. Davis responded, as appropriately as he could, that no one in this column had any idea what the password was, and that the best idea for anyone manning the checkpoint was to move out of the way. The officer complied. Just outside the checkpoint, the Royal Marines had performed one last dangerous task, eliminating an advance by a small body of enemy troops, what might have been a last costly firefight for the men down on the road. Their job complete, Drysdale's men positioned themselves along the line of march, welcoming the Americans with calls of good cheer, as well as cigarettes and chocolate bars. With barely a quarter mile to go before entering the perimeter, Colonel Davis ordered a halt, passing the word that any man who could march would now do so. Obeying the call, the trucks held back. The Marines, including dozens of walking wounded, forming up in column. At Davis's command, they began to march once more, moving past the respectful salutes of the Royal Marines. In his jeep, watching them come, Oliver Smith gave himself up to the moment, his own emotions wrapped around those of his men, as Davis's Marines, ragged and filthy and unshaven, made their way into Hogaroo Ree, singing the words every Marine knew so well. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Chapter 34. Riley. Hogaroo Ree, North Korea, December 4th, 1950, 3 a.m. All along the march, Riley had stayed close to the truck that carried so many of the wounded men, including Killian, who rode in the same truck as Lieutenant McCarthy. Around the truck were more wounded, men who could walk, no one trying to hitch a ride if it meant crowding those men who were so worse off. They had come into Hogaroo Ree several hours behind Davis's 1st Battalion, but the greeting they received was no less emotional and no less enthusiastic. The British were there still, passing out hot coffee, which very quickly lost its burn. For men who had not tasted coffee in days, the cooling off was welcome. Tender faces also meant tender mouths, bleeding gums, and cracked lips. For some, including Riley, the lack of real food had drained their appetites, digestive systems impacted or shut down completely, most of the men unable to make use of a latrine since the assaults had begun. The medical staffs seemed to understand just how poor these men had become, that beneath the layers of frozen crust on their uniforms and faces, malnutrition and dehydration could create one more kind of bedridden casualty. But if a man was fit enough to avoid a visit to the aid station, the staffs guided them in another direction, where the hot food waited. Riley followed the scent, not even his chapped and burnt nostrils able to disguise what was emerging from the mess tents. He followed Welch through the flaps of the big tent, the smells overwhelming now. Besides the amazing odors was the heat, and Riley felt swallowed by warmth, stopped, stared with tired eyes at the men who had already swarmed around the mess tables. They sat in long rows, some of the men barely holding themselves upright. Around them, the mess orderlies slid mounds of food in a steady procession in front of anyone who had the strength to empty his plate. Riley stepped closer, one hand on Welch's shoulder, trying to keep upright, staggering unsteadiness in his knees. "Hey, you boys, there's seats over here." Riley followed the voice, a smiling orderly with his hands on the backs of a pair of metal chairs. Welch stepped that way, Riley following numbly. They reached the chairs and Welch sat heavily, Riley sliding in beside him. Across from him, a familiar face,
one of Barber's aides, the man shoveling something thick and gooey into his mouth, a drool flowing down through the thick stubble on the man's chin. There was a plate put down in front of Riley now, and he absorbed the sight, had a sudden sense that this wasn't real. One more illusion after days of nightmares. No one was speaking, and Welch stuffed a fork into the pile on his plate, Riley fumbling for the fork with the fingers of his rotten gloves. He looked at his hands, tugged at the gloves, pulled them free from his swollen red fingers, tried to pick up the fork, dropped it, and across from him the man said, "Just use your hands if you have to. Worth it. Best damn pancakes I ever eat." Riley put his fingers on the soft mass on his plate, probed. The man smiling, then stuffing a blob of food into his mouth. Beside him, Welch mumbled something, slid a large can toward him, and Riley saw now it was syrup. His mind seemed to wake just a bit more, the smells drilling into his hunger, the juices in his mouth beginning to flow, uncontrollable, his tongue pushing through the dry crust on his lips. He reached out, took the can, poured the syrup clumsily across his plate, the thick liquid pouring out onto the table, an instant mess. He set the can down, wiped at the spill with his fingers, glanced around, embarrassed, heard the orderly behind him. "Don't worry, sport. There's plenty more. Just eat up. More coffee here?" The orderly put two coffee pots on the table, some of the men reaching out, pouring a steaming brew into tin cups. Beside him, Welch said, "You gonna eat those things, or do I have to show you how?" Riley grabbed the fork again, stabbed a thick wad of pancakes, now a soft, gooey blob, stuffed it into his mouth. Across from him, more smiles. "See? Told you so. Cures what's wrong. I'm stuffed to the gills. There's more of us coming in. I'll make room. Enjoy that while you can." The man slid back, moved away, happy talk toward some of the others. More men were coming into the tent, like Riley, moving toward the table with wide, puzzled eyes. He was more energized than he had been in days, the rich sugar from the syrup rolling through his veins like gasoline. The darkness was complete, no stars, just the usual wind, and he felt like returning to the mess tent, his mind embracing the astonishing luxury of the pancakes. But the corpsman had cautioned them all, especially any man whose bowels had shut down, "Don't overdo it. What goes in had to come out, eventually, and already some of the men were suffering the agony of diarrhea." He watched more men coming out of the mess tent, a stark contrast to those still going in, men groaning in the darkness with their hands on their bellies. He couldn't help smiling, thought, "Whoever thought of making up those pancakes gets a medal of honor. If they'd have told us that's what was waiting for us, we might have beat hell out of the Chinese a whole lot sooner." He stood alone in the cold dark, wasn't sure just where to go. Welch off searching for officers, someone to tell them where they were supposed to be. All around the compound, men were standing in groups, huddling together against the windy cold. There were walking wounded as well, corpsmen guiding those men to the aid tents or the larger hospital, what seemed to resemble a ramshackle schoolhouse. Riley felt the cold again, leaking into his coat, his toes numb, his hands stuffed into his coat pocket. He looked toward the aid tents, trucks parked nearby, one more being unloaded, the stretcher bearers moving quickly, a doctor pointing the way. He had no idea what Killian's truck had looked like, just one more out of dozens, but the guilt came now, a full belly, the stickiness still on his fingers. "They must feed the wounded," he thought. "Got to." His mind was racing now, thoughts of Captain Barber, the lieutenant, and all those men who had been carried off the hill in closed-up sleeping bags. Already the graves registration people had gone to work, logging the names, checking them against the rosters from Fox Company, other companies. So many men hauled down from Udom Ni.
There were the missing, too. Two men from 3rd Platoon simply gone. No sign of them. Whether they had been captured or simply buried in some snowy hole under a mass of Chinese bodies. Riley had been a part of the search, the team discovering one other corpse, a Marine from 1st Platoon who had moved out too far, cut down by the enemy, freezing stiff before anyone knew he was gone. All along the march down from the pass, he had thought of what they had left up on the hill. The amazing scene. So many Chinese bodies spread out across every stretch of open ground. Someone had made a count. Barber's aides, maybe, estimating 1,000 enemy soldiers scattered in front of the guns on Fox Hill. Davis's 1st Battalion had been the first to see that, their approach bringing them over the mass of enemy dead. Those Marines had offered salutes for that, raucous congratulations to the men of Fox Company for a job well done. They're still up there, he thought. Nobody buried them. Nobody hauled them off. And one day it's going to be spring. Then what? Somebody goes out there and finds them? Not a job I'd want.
Hey, Pete, you get some pancakes?
He knew the voice of Morelli, saw the kid bounding toward him, more energy than usual.
Yeah, I won't eat for a week. I know, me too. Haven't had coffee that good since I left home. You might want to go back inside. Just as I was getting up, they starting putting out beef stew, noodles, and God knows what else. It's like Christmas dinner and Easter Sunday rolled into one.
Not me, kid. Had all I could handle.
What the hell time is it?
Morelli shrugged.
Maybe 3. I'm going to wait for dawn, then have breakfast.
Riley wasn't in the mood for cheeriness, but he couldn't escape Morelli, the kid beside him now, an over-eager puppy. Riley said, "The Sarge is off finding out what's up. You ought to go look for him." Morelli didn't get the hint, said,
"They say we're leaving this place pretty quick. I also heard we're supposed to stay here until spring, holding the fort and all. The enemy's getting ready to hit us hard. Someone said that, too. Someone else said the war's over. The enemy's done quit. There's an army unit got busted up out east of the reservoir. I heard they might want us to go up that way. Someone else,
and someone else said there's a truck full of gorgeous Hollywood stars on their way here just to lay a wet kiss on you. Jesus, kid, you ought to know better than to listen to all this crap. When they want us to move or fight or eat more pancakes, they'll let us know.
I know. I wasn't sure I'd ever see any of this again. Look how many we are. 2 whole regiments made it back here. Or what's left of them. You see all those British guys all spiffed up like right out of a picture book? One of them slapped me on the back, handed me a pack of cigarettes. Guess I'll start smoking. Don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Through the dull glow from the lantern light, he spotted Welch moving toward him, a hard scowl on his face. Riley was grateful for the distraction, said, "What's up, Sarge?"
"They've got a pile of warming tents set up for us over that way. The captain's in that big tent right there. He's not in command anymore."
Riley felt a jolt.
"Why?" "He's shut up too bad. I talked to Lieutenant Abel, the new CO. He's from 1st Battalion. The captain and Lieutenant McCarthy are both being shipped out. Peterson, too. They're finding somebody to take over 3rd Platoon from the replacements that are coming up here. Transports are hauling new guys in from the ships. Looks like we might get another 90-day wonder. Jesus, Hamp."
Welch stared away, and Riley knew him well enough to know he was holding back emotion. Riley said, "It might not be all that bad. There's probably some good officers still back in Pendleton." Welch still stared away.
"Yeah, like Goolsby."
Riley didn't want to think about him. Had tried not to recall the image of the man's wound, a small river of blood freezing to his forehead.
"I think we ought to go see the captain, if it's okay. And I want to find Killian."
Welch looked at him again, nodded.
"Yeah, I missed that Irish idiot. Maybe his wife sent some more of that good hooch."
Welch started toward the larger tents, Morelli hanging back. Riley looked at him, motioned with his hand. "Come on, kid." Welch led the way to the tent, men emerging with empty stretchers, another truck rumbling up close. Riley looked that way. The faint light from a handful of lanterns reflecting off a mound of bodies lashed to the truck's hood. The driver jumped down now, his arm bandaged, the man staggering to his knees. Riley moved that way, caught the man before he collapsed in the snow. He called out to the corpsman, "Hey! Right here! He's hurt!" The stretcher-bearers moved out from behind the truck, a man hauled between them, one of them calling out, "Corpsman!" Another man appeared out of the big tent now, and Riley stood back, the corpsman kneeling down, talking to the driver, reaching into the man's coat, one hand on the man's neck. The corpsman backed away, still on his knees, the driver tilting slowly, falling to one side. Riley moved closer, said, "Hey, what the hell? Help him inside!" The corpsman looked at him, then away, stood slowly, held out one hand covered in wet blood. He didn't make it. Hole in his chest. Must have had just enough left in him to get his buddies here. "I've been seeing this all night. Just about every truck driver is shot up. This one's a hero." Riley felt a hand on his shoulder, the voice of Welch. "You can't fix it, Pete. Let's go inside." Riley kept his eyes on the driver, felt the agonizing helplessness so familiar now. Like Goolsby, he thought. "Yeah, I gotta see Killian. Make sure he's okay." They moved into the tent, more stretcher-bearers coming out past them, another truck rolling up, a squeal of brakes, another load of wounded, more corpses tied to the hood. He didn't expect to see tears, Killian's words coming out in a spray of cursing. "They're shipping me out. Damn it all. I might never walk again. That's what one jackass said, crippled up forever, on account of these damn shoe-pack boot things." Riley stood silently, Morelli beside him. Welch coming up now. "Hey, Irish, guess you'll get your Purple Heart. I talked to that guy in the white coat. He says you're going home tomorrow." It was Welch's effort at cheerfulness, and Killian said, "Keep the damn medal. Give me back my feet. What's my wife gonna say? They gotta give me a fake foot, maybe half a leg." Killian's voice was carrying, faces looking that way, and Riley felt uncomfortable now, said, "You're going home, Sean. Ain't that enough? You're alive, for Christ's sakes." Killian turned away, the tears still flowing. Riley glanced at Welch, expected anger, saw it. But Welch spoke in low words, his voice calm. "I just saw Captain Barber. He took a bad wound on his thigh, just below his groin. Walking may not be the worst thing he misses. There's a guy over there who's lost half his face. A half dozen down this next row missing a whole limb, some more than one. Tell them how bad your wife is going to feel." Killian looked at Welch, then lay back, closed his eyes. After a long moment, he said, "I don't want to go home, Sarge. I know I'm not all that busted up, but you guys are the whole thing, you know. I got nothing back home. I couldn't hardly get a job before, and now I'm a gimp. Everybody in this place says how great it is that I'm not dead." He paused. "Up on that hill, I kind of felt like it was the right place to cash it all in, like it was my time. I ain't never done anything in my life that felt as good as that. When those shambos were close enough to smell, God, Sarge, it was fun. Now I have to go home and be normal." Hagaru Ree, December 4th, 9 a.m. As they waited for the planes to land, The medical aides had laid the wounded under thick piles of rice straw, each man inside a sleeping bag, no one complaining, even if they were cold. Some of the men were unconscious, heavy doses of morphine, others more excited to be awake, their wounds not erasing the joy at the sight of the C-47s that would haul them south. There were others, too, the quiet ones, and Riley saw faces looking at him, could feel the guilt, the odd need to stay out here, that even if they couldn't fight, they didn't want to leave their units or abandon the men who had shared the foxholes. Riley stayed close to Killian, neither man speaking, Riley fighting the cold, while the Irishman fought his tears. The plane touched down, the ground crews moving quickly, and Riley watched as the plane disgorged its passengers, a dozen men who stepped onto the icy tarmac like green sausages. Replacements, he thought. He was curious about them. Saw men with bandaged hands, their coats worn, dirty, others cloaked in everything fresh. Maybe they're ours, he thought. God, I hope not. Welch had learned that Fox Company had barely 60 effective men, but Lieutenant Abel was anticipating 100 new faces. And none of them will be Killian, he thought. They'll be like the kid, too eager and too stupid. And it will take blood and bullets to teach them anything. Okay, load 'em up. Riley stood back, the crews moving to the wounded men, sweeping away the straw. Each man carried quickly toward the open maw of the plane's belly. He looked again at Killian, saw red eyes staring back, struggled to say something, anything that would matter. Hey, Sean, they got nurses on those hospital ships, you know? There was no response from Killian, and Riley felt idiotic. The crews worked their way down the row. The man beside Killian carried off now. Riley moved closer again, put a hand on Killian's arm. Time to go. It'll be okay. Your wife will be happy as hell to see you. I promise. Killian nodded. More tears. Said, I know. I hate leaving this. That's all. Maybe they'll fix me up and I'll be back. Go home, Sean. Go plant some flowers and mow your grass, and maybe hatch a couple more kids. You sound like Colleen. That's what she wants. It's what we all want. Some of us just don't know it yet. The stretcher bearers were there now. A quick glance at Riley, and one man said, Heads up. You're the last one on this run. Another plane coming in a few minutes. Killian held out a hand, and Riley took it. A hard squeeze. The bearers paused, but Riley could feel their impatience, no one enjoying the cold. He backed away, Killian up and moving, the rumble from the plane's engines sweeping away his words. Riley watched as he was loaded on the plane, felt a man moving up beside him. He glanced to the side, saw Welch, who said, He gone? Yep. He saw now, Welch holding a package, and Welch said, Mail run. Came in this morning. Looks like his wife sent another loaf of bread. Riley looked out toward the plane, moving away now, rolling out toward the strip. Guess he wouldn't need it anyway. Welch shook his head. Nah, they'd have taken it away from him. Regulations and all. Riley looked at the fat package. Welch staring at the plane. Riley said, So, what say we go drink a toast? To Irishmen everywhere.
In a minute.
Riley heard a crack in Welch's voice. Both men watching the plane taxi to the far end of the strip. A hard roar of the engines, the plane moving slowly, gaining speed, lifting off as it passed by. They were both silent, stood for a long moment, and he looked at Welch, the thick grime through the man's ragged beard.
red eyes, and icy tears. Chapter 35. Smith. Hagaru Ri, North Korea, December 4, 1950.
Oh, Lord. He's back.
Smith looked up from the papers on the small table, saw Bowser at the window. There was a loud clatter from the next room, a voice calling out,
General Smith? General Almond wishes to see you outside on the double.
Smith sat back in the small chair, said,
I was just about warm. How many of our dead have we shipped out today?
Bowser kept his gaze out the window. 46. Eight more are wrapped and ready. He's talking to the men, anyone who will stop long enough to listen to him.
Make sure those eight get on the planes today. I know Doc Herring has more wounded he wants out of here, but I want the corpses moved out just as quick. I don't intend to leave trucks or artillery here, and I'm sure as hell not leaving the dead.
Bowser looked at him now. Knew Smith was serious.
I'll see to it.
The last plane in, one of the R-4Ds, had another handful of replacements, some of the lightly wounded from Hung Nam, and the reporters keep flocking in as well.
Smith pulled himself up from the chair. I don't give a hoot about reporters.
Sexton was at the door now, said,
Sir, there's a lieutenant here who says General Almond doesn't care to be kept waiting. They're looking for you to meet with him outside.
Smith felt tired resignation, said,
You may tell the impatient lieutenant I'm coming.
You just told him yourself, sir. Smith saw the man peering over Sexton's shoulder, ignored him, saw his coat in Sexton's hands. He turned, Sexton holding the coat, Smith sliding his arms into the sleeves. He looked at Bowser, saw the hint of a smile.
Don't be so smug. You're coming, too. He might have questions I don't feel like answering.
Bowser retrieved his own coat, said,
I had no doubts, sir. I aim only to please.
Don't we all?
He moved out past Almond's young aide, still ignored him, Sexton holding the door open, a blast of cold wind greeting Smith as he stepped outside. He saw Almond, a half-dozen men gathered around him, an audience that Almond was addressing with obvious enthusiasm. Smith moved that way, his men responding by backing away.
Almond saw him now, said, Ah, Smith, you received my congratulatory letter this morning?
The letter had come that morning by wire, a gush of praise for Smith and his regimental commanders, as though Almond had never been angry at anyone in Smith's command.
We did, thank you.
Nothing to it. And there's more. I should like the lot of you to receive the Distinguished Service Cross, perfectly appropriate under the circumstances. Can you pull them together, the colonels, Murray and Litzenberg? Perhaps your artilleryman, too?
Colonel Youngdale.
Sure, him, too. But be quick about it. I have a rather busy schedule today. I do intend to visit Colonel Puller on my way south, so no need to bother him with this now. I'll save him the trip up here.
Smith absorbed Almond's good cheer, thought, Does he know just how many Chinese are sitting between here and Koto Ri? Well, no, he flew above it all. He looked at Bowser, said,
I suppose we should get the word to all three commanders. Tell them to meet here on the double.
Well, damn it all.
Almond was searching his pockets, obviously frustrated. It seems I